This is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at NightshadeDiary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to SupernaturalStorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news, or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful. Hi, how's everybody doing? Good? Sorry about the face glare. I have to reset my camera on the setting for contrast and all that stuff. So, yeah, I know. But anyway, guys, how's everybody doing? I'm doing good. Prepping for Thanksgiving. And this year, we decided we're not going to go the turkey route. We decided we're going to do Cornish hens. Why not? Make something different. And of course, I'm going to get on my little soapbox again about everything is Christmas, Christmas, Christmas. And I mean, I want to say with the exception of when you go to the supermarket, which of course they're throwing all these food things that, you know, are, you know, holiday based, you know, Thanksgiving. And but let's skip over that. Let's get to, it's almost 2024. God, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. The other day I was telling my husband, you know, it's been 3 years since we moved. And it feels like it was yesterday. It was a difficult thing. It was good, but at the same time, so difficult when you move. And the other day I told him, you know, we've been here 3 years. And he's like, what? Well, 3 years. Yeah. And I feel like this thing with the new year is along the same lines. It's 2024. Before you know it, 2025. And I'm going to say what I say. I remember when being a kid, you told a kid, it'll be a year. And a year was like an eternity. A year? God, a year? Yeah. And now it's like a year is nothing. It is nothing. I'll give you another example. I'll buy tickets to concerts. And sometimes I want good seats. I buy stuff out that's months out. I put it on my calendar. I'm thinking, okay, well, I've got time. The next thing I know is, hey, the concert's here. And I'm like, holy crap. I mean, I'm talking, I've bought concert tickets 8-9 months out just because it's something I wanted to see and I want to get good seats. So I'm willing to like, and here it is. We're back to, yeah. You know, and I don't know what changes. Is it time goes by quicker or is it the way you look at it? You know, your perception of it, or, which I think is part of it, we're so caught up with the pace of life. By the way, I'm going to say this because I'm old enough to compare it. You know, there was a time when my kids were younger that, yeah, it's intense. You've got kids and taking them there, and time goes by very, because you're so caught up the days, but my kids are grown up. So I don't even have that thing of where I'm so busy that time flies. I'm busy, but not a kid thing. It's still the same thing's happening. It's like, wow, why is time going by so quick? I mean, I have all my kids are in their 30s. And I look at them. I think I have to remind myself about that. How's that? I have to remind myself, man, my kids are, you know, it's like, I can remember when I was in my 30s. And yeah, it's like incredible. About that thing about how we perceive time and how fast it goes for us. But anyway, let's get on to the good part. The good part is the guest that's here today at Stories of the Supernatural. She's been here before. Her name is Anita Joantenzo. She's a published author of 2 nonfiction paranormal books, A State of Horror and Dark Transference, which were the inspiration for the episode Portal of Doom on a haunting TV show that premiered on Destination America in 2014. She's been interviewed numerous times on different podcasts, radio shows, And she's also done joint interviews with author and deliverance minister Bill Bean, which, by the way, I'm scheduling for now into the new year, just an aside. Anita has written articles on supernatural topics for online magazines like Haunted Radio Magazine and Let's Talk Magazine. She also writes a popular blog based on her ghost experience with over 220,000 page views on her 77 blogs. And I'll put a link for that in the credits of the show, by the way. She's also classically trained. She's also classically trained as a fine artist. She graduated with honors from Moore College of Art and Design in Philadelphia, earning a BS degree in art education. And she taught art for many years, and her oil paintings hang in numerous private collections throughout the United States. She also restores old photos for over 42 years, and she created her business, Past Images, in 2000, where she preserves and restores family treasures, photos, paintings, antique dolls, so that their history will endure for future generations. Genealogical and historical societies seek her out for her expert consultations, lectures, and appraisal. She was recently featured in an article by her alma mater, Moore College of Art and Design, at an Alumni of Interest in 2019. She lives with a family and several stubborn resident ghosts in the Philadelphia suburbs on a property dating back to the 1800s. Help me welcome her. How are you doing today, Anita?
Doing very well, Marlene. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
And the thing about the photos, people don't realize that now with all this digital stuff, your original photos, one of my things of when I was redoing my closets, and when you open stuff and you're like, oh, so that's where this is, and I found some of my photos. And you realize that even if you keep them, organized or covered up, they can still fade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It happens because of the chemicals that maybe were used when the pictures were actually developed. And unfortunately, some of the more modern pictures, like from the 60s, done with the Polaroid cameras, and some of the dyes they use faded more than pictures from the 1900s, because they used a way different process than we do now. And they were done in a lot more of a conservation kind of way, because the kind of materials they used were more of a cotton kind of a cotton or rag linen paper. And today's papers have much more sawdust and synthetics in it. So what it does, the acid in those oils from the trees originally, from anything after 1920s or so, because it was cheaper to produce those actual oils from the trees, and those rosins actually yellow and fade the pictures even worse. So
people don't realize pictures, those are younger.
They hold up even better. Yeah.
Well, that once upon a time, people would go into studios to take family. I mean, besides graduations, which is what everybody thinks about. Once upon a time, people would either go to a portrait or even have a photographer come over to shoot, photographs of the family, like actual studio stuff. Yes. That was common. Oh God, what was that? Olin Mills with one of them. There was a couple of studios. That it was normal. People would take.
Well, I used to work
the family portrait kind of deal. Yeah, those.
Yes. That family portrait. Well, and that was a thing that people would do that every so often during special stages in their life, and that was because it was expensive, and they didn't have portable cameras in like we do today, so it was something that they treasured, for like a family wedding or a get together or maybe a reunion. But the older pictures are really fantastic for the costumes. I mean, what they wore, and you can actually date things by hairstyles and the kinds of composition they're in. So a lot of times people ask me, can you give me an idea how old the picture is? And, sometimes you can get within a 10-year range because of the way they're dressed, because the styles change like every 10 years. And they are some of them are so beautiful. I'm fascinated when I see these gorgeous 1890s and 1900s.
Right, and people used to dress up.
They need some work done on them. So to me, it's always
they would put on their Sunday best, to take these pictures.
It's they put on their Sunday best. Yes,
because they wanted to be
It's been a very rewarding type of.
Well, and I know this isn't. But, and that gets into, the Victorian times, where they would take pictures of the deceased loved ones, because they didn't have, unless you were better off that you had a portrait.
Yes, mortem photos,
they would do that. And you think of it as being really morbid.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I've had a fascination with some of those have come across my path through. I've been over 45 years, I've been restoring pictures. And a lot of them, they're really a beautiful tribute because that was maybe the only picture they would have of that person or child. Usually it was children because so many children died before they were even 5 years old in the Victorian times. People forget that, you know, things today we take for granted with the vaccines and, you know, antibiotics. Children just died of like measles or chickenpox or even, you know, diphtheria, scarlet
They didn't
fever.
know how to
So, you know,
diagnose
during
it.
those years, exactly. And, you know, they didn't know how to treat it. So the children passed and they would take these photos in the family home and they were treasured, you know. And some of these, there's a whole big collection. There's whole big groups on Facebook and through when I've been in the photography community that actually collect those types of photos. And they're really just for, it's historical references. There's no real kind of creepiness surrounding them. Yes, they could be very disturbing some, but if you know what this was all about, then you understand it's actually a
The
beautiful
intent was
tribute
not being
to
morbid.
some of
The
these
intent
deceased
was
people, because that was the last image.
right. And let's people don't, even there was no camera, or even if you had a photographer, but when you see, with the ones with the puff, that still that was something that you're not going to have
Oh,
one
yeah.
recently that you could come.
Yeah.
So yeah, this was sometimes the best they could do as far as, like you said, a remembrance. And I know some people think, oh, but hey, different times,
Exactly.
like I tell everybody, oh, when you hear about these haunted houses that say, oh, people died there, I go, once upon a pe time people would have their children and die in the same house. This was common. And it was just or then you
And
would
they would
hear that
hold
they would have,
their wakes would be
yeah, if it was big enough,
Wakes would be in the homes too, because my mother, yeah. Well, my mom, she was 91 when she passed, and she told me the story of her grandmother when she passed. They lived in South Philadelphia. They had a three-story house, which the upper floor was made an apartment. They used to have tenants, but when everybody lived together, my grandparents and the great grandparents and my mom, the whole family. But when she passed away, the embalmer came and performed whatever he needed to do in the bedroom, and then she was laid out in the living room, you know, and they had the vigil for her, that was their wake. And then of course she was buried after that. But my mother always said, you know, she was like a young person, that she happened to go by, the room wasn't completely, door wasn't completely closed, and she saw, you know, the doctor there, and he was near, you know, her dead grandmother, and was doing what he needed to do, you know, for the embalming. And so she used to tell us about that. But she said, yes, she said, and they would cover the mirrors, you know, as a thing where they didn't want spirits to go through the mirrors. They would, you know, clad them in material for the mirrors. And you know, also the prayers and things, keep, you know, candles lit near the body. And that's what, you stayed up all night, you stayed all
Right,
night
and
with the
but
body
there was
until the next
nothing,
morning, when then they were going to have the funeral.
right. So when you hear people die in the house, it's like, yeah, we know we're our modern sensibilities, we get creeped up. But before it was the norm. It was the norm where, people died in the house because even if you were sick a while, your family took care of you. Like as far as the nursing home thing didn't, people would stay in the house and they would have some family look after them. And
Oh,
then they
no,
would
they
do
didn't
a
have
wake
anything.
and then, off to the church and or wherever, and then off to the cemetery. And I remember my grandmother. She was telling me, I remember the story. She tells me that she had a woman. She was young. She had tuberculosis. My grandmother was born in 1911, so this must have been 1930s. She was young herself, and she says, "Look, I want you to come over, and I'm going to give you what the clothing I want to be used, when I die, because." In other words, she wanted my grandmother to make sure she got dressed this way and that they were going to have the wake in the house. And my grandmother was young. I think my grandma was in her 20s when this happened. And it wasn't like disturbing. It was like, hey, your neighbor wants you to make sure that this is how they dress me. And she was a young woman. This was, around the time, tuberculosis was could kill you. It was more common in the 1930s.
Oh yeah, that was rampant. Yeah. That was a real, so many people, you know, people that even came from overseas. But I mean, my grandparents came through Ellis Island, and from they came from Naples, Italy, and
right.
Yeah, there were people that got sent back because they were not well, or they screened them, you know, and they had you know, tuberculosis or whatever, and they could not stay in the country. They had to be shipped back. Or if someone was getting over maybe an illness like the flu or something, they had to be quarantined for a few weeks before they could get their pass. And then because family were actually meeting other people there, they had sent usually first group would come
right, and then
and
your
get
family.
Settled, and then they would send for the rest of the family, you know.
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
yeah, in this way they would know people there already.
That even single women, you had to show that you were engaged to somebody to be married. In other words,
yes. A lot of times they would have paperwork, that you would have to have with you that make sure there's someone who's going to be meeting you there. Or you just weren't there, left on your own devices, because you know then they didn't know what your occupation was. You know they. You know,
well,
so
I think
you know,
they kind of suspect.
Woman,
really,
you're coming with your children because your husband would be there.
Yeah, but yeah, even single women.
Because my great grandfather.
She's gonna end up in the prostitution if.
Yeah, like they. Yeah, they think that they're doing something illegal. Eagle, you know, where they're being trafficked here first in Philadelphia. And he was working on churches in South Philly because he was a sculptor. And so then he was here for several years. And then he set for my great grandmother. And at the time, my grandfather was only 4 years old. So they came from where they were from, up Rootsy. So because we have my mom, I'm Italian on both sides of the family. So, you know, he was already established and he set for his wife, you know, and son. And and then of course they were here in South Philly for the rest of their lives because I still have family in South Philly. I was born in South Philly and then moved into the suburbs outside of Philadelphia many years ago. But it's you know, everybody you kind of it's interesting because I work with genealogy groups, being that I'm doing photographs, you learn the history of different places. And also with my writing and, you know, researching some of the things in my books, I've had to do research because of the circumstances we found ourselves in when I was clearing out my friend's house in the first book. You know, it's mostly about being the executor of his home and trying to find
out.
Yeah,
I was going to tell you
what I needed to do
that
because
for,
he died
for,
suddenly. My friend, he was only 50.
Right, how that happened, which was. You know what? I was looking at I was looking at your book.
Yeah.
He was, you know, at the. It's, I mean, you know, and it was like you never realized at the beginning that your friend first of all had made you what executrix, and that he had a lot of stuff in his house.
Uh-huh.
It was like a big wake up call when you got there.
Well, I knew him for about 30 years and he was only 55 when he died of a sudden heart attack. So that was something where, they called me the next morning and I didn't know he was in the hospital and they called me cause I was his contact. He wasn't his parents had passed before him and he was estranged from his older brother. So I was like family to him, my son and I. So, you know, going to his home and clearing things out, which was very eerie because I had the call from the hospital. They said he was there, that he was very ill, but by the time I got there, he had already passed. They had taken him down for surgery and he didn't make it past. Like they couldn't even save his life because he had such massive blockage in the heart valve. So, but I had to be there to claim his body, to say who he was, you know, make sure I was identified. And
you,
then, you know, just
you had to
his
do
home
that too?
After that ordeal.
Wow.
Yeah, I had to go to the place there and, you know, make arrangements. I mean, he had left me a detailed will. He had left a will with the lawyer and then he sent me a copy because he was traveling overseas a few years before that. And he said, I want to keep all this information with you, Anita, in case something happened to me overseas. So he had the forethought to do that. So when the time came, I had everything in an envelope in my desk. So when this happened, I just opened it up and there was the contacts for the lawyer and, you know, his brother and all that. So it made it a little bit easier for me to kind of, but it was still like a shock because like I'm trying to you know, sort of like take this all in that he's gone. You know, I had to say goodbye to him in a side room. You know, he was just there. And then from there going to his home to make sure, because he had two cats that I didn't know, you know, if anybody had taken care of them for a few days.
Sure.
So I made sure that I called this fellow who had taken care of his cats before. I knew who he was. And I called him. I said, look, you know, this is a circumstance. Can you meet me there and just check on the cats? Because I don't know what condition they're in. You know, he's dead. He passed away this afternoon and he's been gone since yesterday. You know, they took him to the hospital. Mm-hmm. So yes, we had to do all that, but just to see the hoarding situation in his home, my friend right. traveled all around the world and collected things. So there was room and room there filled with just containers and boxes and stuff everywhere that after his parents died, he just kind of took over the rooms and had things spread out. But it took us 10 months to clean out his house from all the things in the basement and in the rooms that he had stored. And I still have quite a few. He left me so much of his artifacts and things. That was part of the cause of, I think, what the haunting was all about, because
like what you said, it wasn't just
so
that he was a collector.
Countries, South America.
He's what they call like an organized hoarder.
No, he was an anthropologist it was in boxes, but then you didn't know everything what was in the boxes. I was constantly surprised like how much he had collected about different things. His bedroom alone had just stacked of the Tupperware bins were things inside, and you know, some things you could see, but others I was just really shocked how much he did accumulate. And that was like, you know, its own journey, just to go through things, see what had to go to people in his will, because he left so many different things to people overseas, to across the country. There was a friend of his that he wanted to have certain things. So it was a process of 10 months to go through, not just being the executor, make sure to pay the bills and make sure the home was secure, but also you're just going through tons of stuff, you know, each day. We were putting 40 hours a week in, my son and I.
It was a full-time job, in other words.
I mean, he had been working for a multimedia company and they had laid. And he was laid off most of the. And so I said to him, look, I'm going to be able to do this only with your help, because I just don't know what's here. We just can't have strangers in here. So I spoke with the lawyer and I said, look, can we just put my son on just an hourly rate, very reasonable rate, because he's going to help me clear out things. And there's nobody else right now who he can get in here that would be very respectful of the things that we're finding. You know, I don't want a complete stranger in here, because there's a lot of personal papers that have to be going
right,
through.
Yeah,
my son knew my friend Paul for years and years. So yeah. And that was the main thing. So we had to get all that in the effects, and then just going through the things and starting getting the haunting. The poltergeist activity was almost immediate. Within a matter of a few weeks, we started clearing out things and strange stuff started happening. Whereas things are flying across the room, things are being thrown off a shelf. We had been in his bedroom and we're moving Tupperware bins out and we're trying to organize and had, you know, in between throwing out trash and things that needed to be gone through that weren't anything special. But as soon as we moved out of his room one day, we were in another room, we heard a terrible crash and we were both surprised, because I said, I don't know what came down. It sounds like a shelf. But when we got into the room here, there had been some Tupperware bins against the back wall, and those had been thrown from the wall end to the middle of the room. And one of the lids came off one of the Tupperware bins. That's how hard it was thrown and spilled out some of the contents. And I said, I don't know what's going on, but this is like really crazy, because we were nowhere near those bins, you know, for them to be thrown out. So that was the beginning, you know, of like,
let me ask you something. While he was alive, did he ever by any chance mention things going on in the house when he was alive? Did he ever tell you anything by any chance? Prior
to
his death?
No, the only thing I thought was strange, he was very close to his father passed away in the 90s, and then he was just he and his mother, and he was very devoted to his mother. She was a wonderful person and she was very good friends with me. When she passed, he said to me on a phone call, because I used to call I would check on him a couple times a week to see how he was doing, mm-hmm. because it was a great loss to him. He actually nursed her. She had fallen and had broken her hip and in and out of the hospital. And in the meantime, he's taking care of her at home. He was working as a director for a retirement home as an activities director. And he had to stop all that because he was caring for her, didn't want her to go in a nursing home. So after she passed, he told me, he said, you know, I feel that she's around me, that, you know, he was playing music that they both loved, that kind of made him give him solace, you know, that he would listen to the music. Sure. But he said, I feel like she's around, you know. And I said, well, you know, I wouldn't have no doubt, because you were very loving and kind to her, Paul. So, you know, maybe she's just letting you know to thank you for being, you know, such a good son. And that was the only time. But he did say to me, if something happened to him, we had spoken back and forth. And I said, and he said, look, if something happened to me, you know, or if something happened, he said, would we try to get in touch with each other? And I said, why are you talking this way? I said, we're both young people. Right. I said, that's really morbid. No, he said, but promise me, if something happened, that, you know, we'll try to get in touch with each other. And I said, okay, well, I promise. And that was just let go.
And you're thinking,
and
wow.
And then I thought back of that later when he passed. Yeah, well, that will be for years, you know. And, yes. and then lo and behold, you know, he passes away, you know, at fairly young. And, you know, then when I saw these things happening in the house, I knew that it was him. I said, I think he's really not sure that he passed, because he died suddenly. And suddenly, maybe he doesn't know he even passed. So I said to just the air, and if anybody saw me, they would put me in a loony bin. But I just said, do you know that he passed? That I'm here taking care of your house like you told me to. I said, so I'm just letting you know that you died. So, I mean, but yeah, there was other things that I write in the book that only I and he would know. And when he would do something or something would happen in the house, I go, now that's him, because only he and I knew that, like, private joke, or knew what a meaningful thing would be. And I just knew it would be who he was trying to contact me. So, yeah, when you have close relationship with people, you know,
especially the length of
time. It wasn't you're in a house. Knowing him for so long, knowing his taste, we had similar tastes, and we loved art history and anthropology and archaeology. And in fact, that's how I met him. He was doing a lecture at a local library on anthropology about his Native American things that he was doing in South America. And I had gone to the lecture, and we met, and we became fast friends after that, because he didn't live that far from me. I didn't realize, you know, that he had been also an educator. We both love so much of the same thing. His brother had been an artist. So it's like there was a lot of common ground that we became really good friends. And, you know, and when he passed, it was like really a hard thing for me, because we used to have, you know, hours long conversations on the phone about all kinds of like stuff that he was researching, or he had been down to South America and Guatemala studying the Mayan Indians, which I thought was really cool. And then he was supposed to go down again, and they canceled his whole thing because they were afraid of the guerrilla warfare down there. And they said, no, we can't guarantee your safety.
Yeah, they were kidnapping people.
Your trip down there with the research. So he had to wind up in, I mean, he couldn't take a chance. And the university that he was connected with wouldn't vouch for that. So he wound up in Southwest United States, down in Utah. And I never forget that he says, I'm going to be doing a ghost town. He said, big deal. I want to do Native American. Well, he calls me about a week later and said, guess what? We found an Indian burial ground underneath while we were doing the ghost town. So that made him really excited that he could use his studies, you know, in that instead, because he just thought it was boring to him to do the, you know, the old West stuff. You know, he wanted to do the Native American thing. So that was kind of a bonus that they found that the more that they dug to found near the foundations of the house, they found, you know, remnants of this Native American culture. So it was that we had a lot of fun, a lot of good time together. So, you know, me trying to take care of his home was to me a labor of love, and also to the commitment of a friendship that was years, you know, connections. So I just, you know, I did what I could, but it, you know, there was so much that we were unexpectedly facing that we had no guidelines. We weren't, you know, ghost hunters. We weren't people that, you know, went on any of these tour things, after you watched the shows on TV, but that was it.
So, I remember you told me once you finally got, like you said, 10 months, that you're like, this is done. Something followed you home, right? And did you think, okay, what's with this?
The time we were in that's why I wrote the second book, Dark Transference, because we were moving things into my home because he left me a lot of his artifacts and things. He had a complete will outlined what he needed for where the people were to go. And then he said, all this then belongs to Anita. So it's like, wow, this is a lot of stuff, you know, like I had no idea, you know, Native American things and things from, you know, Egypt and Italy. And so I said, look, my basement is pretty empty. Let me start putting things down there because I'm not going to hire a storage unit right now because I just don't know to go through things. So I just started piling stuff in my basement, not knowing what I was transferring or what was falling home with the artifacts, you know, into my basement. So no sooner we closed that place, you know, his place and got a buyer for the home, which was going to gut the house and then resell it. And we no sooner closed the door on that place in October. And then by December, right before activity in my house. And that was just like, oh my gosh, here we go again. Like we could hear the signs. Like when you hear something being thrown against your front door and your son and I, you know, we looked at each other. I go, oh no, could you believe this again, that this is happening? And there was like on the front door, there was a woman's hair clip that I had never seen before was thrown against the front door. And this was actually Christmas Eve of 2009, December 2009. And then we had things thrown that afternoon, crazy stuff that I write in the second book. And I said, I don't know what's going on over here, but I think something is now here. And, you know, it did, like we figured, you know, this was it. You know, we finally could get back to a normal life after 10 months of really extreme craziness at my friend's house. We had friends, Chris's friends would come over and help us just take trash out of the basement because we just needed an extra pair of hands. And they would see things. They said, you know what? I'm not coming back after I, you know, like this is crazy over here. I'm not coming back.
Your
here.
Helpers
you know?
Were like, so,
you know, you're using these people like, oh, I've got all these people in the family. Nobody wants to come back after they see if like they're skeptical. And then something happens and they say,
not anymore.
I didn't believe until I could see this. So
right. They were willing to help. It wasn't the problem. Wasn't like, the help part. It was the ghost part. It was, that's the one that they were like, I don't think so.
Yeah. The ghost part. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we had to tell people ahead of time, a few, like we kept it within a small circle of people because you just couldn't have anybody go in my friend's house because we were afraid somebody could get hurt. My son was thrown to the ground. I was thrown to the ground outside of in the backyard near a little garden house. And we were physically attacked. I mean, and we knew that wasn't my friend. It was other things that were sort of coming in with what we realized there was a portal in his basement and things were coming in there. And the same thing happened in my house where there's portals that open and there's opportunists, we call them opportunist ghosts, whereas something might come through in a totally benevolent nature. And then other things that go, oh, wait a minute, there's a door open. Let's go, guys. You know, let's see what we can cause havoc. And we've had we've had negative energy, positive energy, but we've had our friend Bill Bean, who's a deliverance minister. He's been to my house at least half a dozen times that he comes for we call them booster shots, you know, for he'll clear the house and things will be fine for a while. And they've been relatively calm the last few years, especially, but he came in 2018. That was the last time he was here because then COVID. He's been wanting to get up to our home this past year, but he was ill. And, you know, we had photos we took of the basement that were absolutely crazy. The images we caught that were reflected on I guess it would be the metal ductwork to a heater. And this face appeared that Bill just said, that's inhuman. It's not.
Yes.
We've been documenting all along, Marlene. We've had recordings, EVPs. Yeah.
No, something with enough kinetic strength to throw you guys, plus all the other stuff, that's usually a sign of possibly an inhuman spirit. Because normally, you know, the other stuff that's a regular dead person, all you get is like the, you know, like you said, maybe the steps or, you know, it's much milder things. And like you said, this is not your friend. Did you ever narrow?
No.
I'm thinking the culprit here had to be one of those items that you brought over there. That had some type of attachment.
Well, it's a combination of some of the things. Well, some of the items, there were some from Peru. There was one item in particular in from Peru that, you know, we've had problems with. We find that it's a shapeshifter. We can't locate it. It changes to protect itself. And we were warned that when we had our friend who's a medium came to his house, because we needed to get some kind of verification before we sold the place. And she said, I don't know if you're going to find when you get back to your house, Anita, that if this is ending, because she saw an inhuman kind of a gray creature in one of the rooms. And she said, that's not human. Mm-hmm. She said, that's something that's not supposed to be here. And then she said, I don't know what you're going to have at your house. So I was a little bit dumbfounded, but she was right. And we have shadow people here, like we did at his house. In fact, I was sitting in my living room and watching television one night, and the hallway just faces, we have a center hall. And it, right as I'm watching television, I could see my hallway, and there's this dark 6 foot tall creature with a hat, that's a shadow man, just going right down the hall and through the front door. And I go, well, that's something you don't see every day. Like, what the heck was that? You know, and he's appeared other times in our basement. He's not a really good guy because we think it might be the remnants of a previous owner that was here in the 1900s on my property that apparently committed murdered his wife. So we did not know this until we started doing research of the property, because
find this out afterwards, like you said, when you were doing
research? House was on doing research for my second book, because we were trying to get verification. First of all, our property, we're on the foundation of an 1800s farmhouse. We're actually the old farmhouse. And as I said, we're in the outskirts of Philadelphia. And the area was settled originally by Welsh Quakers. And so what I've realized now, dating back, because when we dig in our property for gardening, we find all kinds of pottery and artifacts. And now we've dated back not only to the 1700s, was part of a 4,000 land tract farm that belonged to the David Lewis family in 1682. And then our property is what's left of that originally 4,000 acres. And we have like a half an acre of ground left. And our house has been continually inhabited, the property, for the last several hundred years. And when Bill Bean came to the house for the first time, he said, there's been a lot of living and dying on this property, Anita. I said, well, we have an underground railroad station that's right up the street. That it's an old inn from the 1812. Was an old inn when we're not far from a highway that was one time a boardwalk. It wasn't even cement; it was just made of boards, and it was one of the main arteries that you left Philadelphia to go to your summer homes. People left Philadelphia because the summers in Philadelphia are so hot and humid, so they would come out here in the suburbs to the country, supposedly, 12 miles away. And they would have these homes built, you know, for the summer. So this one property was an inn that the travelers on their way to Westchester, which is, you know, another 10, 12 miles away.
Right. This was the route. It was a route that was used.
So this inn is still in existence. And that was part of the Underground Railroad Station, where the Quakers had that whole system up here. And all along Westchester Pike, which is our main highway, they had railroad stations. And when I lived only about 5 miles from here, I grew up in Upper Darby, that also there was an old mansion that was torn down. And that also was an underground railroad station that you heard rumors, you know, that these old places that had hidden closets and, you know, places in the basement that were, you know, put off, that there were hidden chambers. Well, we found out that this home that's at the corner of our street, that is this mansard, it's a mansard roof building that's been restored through the years. They had a fire there about 20 years ago. The third floor apartment, they had to gut the walls. And when they opened up the walls, they found slave chains in the walls. So they knew that there had been these closets that had been wallpapered over and that there were these hidden chambers. And that was an underground railroad station. So now when Bill Bean came, he said, Anita, there's tunnels in your backyard. And I said, I've heard that before, that there's tunnels in the back of our property that date back from the Civil War. Now the townships have sealed up the manhole covers that nobody can get down there. But years ago, kids used to go down the tunnels to get away from the police if they were having drinking parties, you know, from what I understand. Right. So this whole area is really chock full of history. And you know, we're on property that living and dying has been here. We're, my son has seen, you know, children, you know, he's seen a little boy and they were in this, we think there's two children's graves in our backyard that's been told to us by the one of the I guess it was the Tri-County Paranormal Group came, and they independently went to the same place with their dowsing rods and didn't tell each other till after they were all done, where did you go? And they all went to the same place. And my son told me, he said, well, he told me which place it would be. And it was the place that he never told them. And it was the same place that they believed that these children died, like maybe in the 1800s. And our area is zoned country. So you're allowed to bury farmland. And if there was no churches by, you know, where are you going to bury? Because they were few and far between at that point to have a graveyard or, you know, a churchyard. So the people probably buried. So that's something that is a legend or it's been told to us, but it would verify why we have children's spirits have gone through the house at different times, hearing laughter, we get smells of different things, you know, of perfume, or you're smelling cigarette smoke or pipe tobacco kinds of things. And it's just that there's been a lot of living and dying probably on the property. And we
people don't realize back then
when we brought these artifacts in, that's why I call it dark spirit. Yeah. We didn't know what we were bringing in, but our medium friend had said to us, there was already docile spirits here. They were just minding their own business. But when you brought this other.
Oh boy. So let me ask you, Anita, when, because people don't realize that back then, as far as religious services, they had what they call those chapels of ease.
Fighting each other because that's really great.
So basically this person, came in, by the way, I'm going to stop you. Did his house, did your friend's house eventually get sold? And did the new occupants ever say anything?
The house has been sold four times over, Marlene.
Okay.
So we don't know what's going on over there.
Okay. That's very.
It's funny because, we knew the first people that bought it, it was just a 2-year stint because the man was transferred. But after that, we were seeing it up for sale again. And then, so now I don't know how long these last people have been there because they've done a lot of work. We drive by his house all the time because where our store's located isn't far from where his house is. And we just look at that. I go, nobody would know behind those walls. Like what went on those 10 months that we were trying to do that. And my son said, well, maybe they do because, you know, the house has been back and forth, but what's a really strange thing about with the house, we thought we were done with it. We've been at our store. We're starting our 10th year in business, having the hobby store. My son started it and we were co-owners, but we weren't getting our cable bill for the store because we have a TV that we run movies on and there's our internet and of course our phone. So I noticed like one October, I said, you know, we didn't get the cable bill this month. I said, I wonder why. I hope it didn't get lost or so. So we asked our other tenants that next door, the other people, no, we didn't see your bill. So that went on for a month. And then the next month I didn't see the bill again. So I finally call and I said to them, this is our number. This is our, could you look this up? Why we're not getting the bill. I said, you know, we hope it's not lost or somebody, you know, walked away with it. So she looked it up. She goes, well, she said, what, you know, I gave her address and everything and the account number. She says, oh, she said, somebody called in and asked to have your bill diverted to another address. I said, what are you talking about? I go, who would call you to divert the bills to another address? So I said, well, what's the address? So she gives me the address. And I said to my son, does this sound familiar to you? It was my friend's address. That there was, what? And there was nobody living there at the time. That wow. I have no idea to this day. Nobody was living, and these bills were going to the house. We don't know who called, why they had her account number. And I said to the girl, well, if they want to pay my bill, they can go right ahead. But yeah, I said, this sure. is a business that we have, and that's a residential. So I said, those bills aren't being paid because they're going to a home that there's no occupant. That it's up for sale, that house. So she said, well, first of all, she said, we're sorry about this. We're not going to charge you for late fees. I said, send me by email the bills. I'll pay them off. But I said, please, I want you to go back to our original address and put a code word and password so nobody ever does this
right,
again.
Like a security
thing. I wrote a blog on that, Marlene, that said, the ghost hijacked my cable bill, because I've
that
never
incredible.
Heard anything
that
like
is
that.
So
and she
weird.
Said, that is a strange story. That's a crazy story. Of all the places, of all the, I said to her, are you kidding me? Why that address? I said, she said, I don't know who called in. We don't know if it was male or female. And I said,
that
but then
so
they had
weird.
Our account number to change it. So I said, maybe somebody's like looking for attention, but to this day. And then also from my friend's house, when we first were there, we had to put a security system. We had to change the passwords. And he had a phone number that we were allowing it to pick up messages because we had to transfer over. And there's people that didn't know that he passed suddenly. So we had to do that too. But then I started paying all the bills. So the bill was MCI at the time. And the bill had coming from his house at 4:30 in the morning. They were calling the relay station, which was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is like an hour or two away. That something was calling from his house, calling the relay station. So I called them and I said, there's a toll number on here for your number. Cause I called the number. And when I called that number, it was weird. Like it was a weird kind of like, I don't know, computer, yeah. but it didn't make any sense. It would connect and then click shut. So when I finally called the billing office, I said, can you run a trace? She said, yes, calls were coming from that house. But I said, they're every week, the same time on a Tuesday for a solid month. I said, nobody's at that house at 4:30 in the morning. I have no idea who's calling your relay station. I said, the person passed away. So that went on for several months. They were taking off every time that happened because they did not know how they could correct this. She said, usually we call during the night just to check to see the line's okay, but you would never know that. There's no reference that you would know that we would call,
right.
but there's no idea. There's nobody ever called from there. So we got all those toll charges taken off because it was like a dollar each time it called.
Right.
And once we took off the MCI account, they were no longer servicing the area. We went to Verizon. The call stopped. As soon as we changed companies, there was no, and to this day, we don't know who was making the calls at 4:30.
That is so unusual, Anita.
You know,
think about it.
So, like weird stuff like that. Yeah. It's just so much strange stuff. That's why I wrote two books, Marlene. Because
You know what?
You can't remember anything. You have to write a book about it.
I imagine. See, when you first got that thing about your friend passing away, you didn't know what was coming with it. It was like, wow. And I think that's so interesting that you're saying this house is gone up for sale 40 times. And I know one time you already knew, well, it's going to be a short term, relatively speaking. But yeah, that it's coming up and it's being sold.
Yeah.
Sounds like every couple of years.
Yeah, there's something there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. We didn't know until after the contractors were working there. They had a few, we found out later there was a few little silly, like, the garage door would keep going up, you know, and then they finally had to take the garage doors off, did new, mechanical pieces in it. But we had where the door would open when we wouldn't even be a block from the house, and the garage
so
door.
Incredible! The garage
open.
Door.
And the and the remote was in the house, so we didn't even have the remote on us. So my son said, "Ah, they know we're here. There's the garage door open by the remote." And one day, Chris had his friends there. They had spent several hours helping us. And they had to leave because one fellow had to work at 5. So I said, look, it's around 3:30, quarter of 4, guys. I'm going to get you home in time. I thank you for helping us out. So we were close. One door had to be stay permanently shut because the mechanics were broken and we just made sure it was locked. The other door opened because we had to get in. There were things in the garage we had to clear out. So that was only so we were in there trying to clear stuff out. And I said, okay, we'll close the door. So no sooner I close the door, I walk away and the door goes back open. And I looked, I go, okay, maybe I didn't close it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't press it. Press it again, door closes. I walk away and the door goes up again. So I said to Christopher, I said, look, I said, like, you press that and I'll guide the door down. So we did, made sure it was right down to the floor, walk away, and the door opens again. And so in the meantime, before that happened, I had left the remote on the kitchen table. So I said, look, Chris, I want you to go in, go get that remote. I don't know why the door keeps going open. So he calls me out from the window. He goes, the remote's gone. I go, what do you mean it's gone? I just left it on the table. I said, the door's open. How am I going to close the door? There's no way for me to close this. So meanwhile, his friends are hysterical because they think this is crazy because this is like back and forth for like 5 minutes. So I said, you know what? I've just about had enough of this. So I said, I'll show them. I went into the house. We're supposed to close up. I went down to the basement without even turning the light on. I wasn't even afraid at that point. I was so angry. And I said, look up. I said, all right, guys, listen up. If you don't return that remote right now, I said, I will bulldoze this house down. So help me God. I will make sure this house is bulldozed down. So my son calls up like, Mom, the remote's back. It's on the table. I said, good.
Really?
That's more like it. So we closed the door. And then I think I tied the door from I go, I'm taking the remote with me. From now on, I'm not leaving that remote. But I'll tell you more. I mean, nobody would believe this stuff, this crazy stuff with the door.
That is incredible.
Just like, what else can we do to make you go crazy? You know, like they just love doing.
You laid down the law.
Pack something away, and I'm giving my son grief. I thought you packed that. I did pack it. Well, guess what? It's out again. Okay, now we have to wrap it again. I mean, you go up the steps from the basement to up into the kitchen, and stuff would fly over your head. Go through the kitchen. We'd have the door. There was a little porch, and all the doors would be open because it was in the summertime. So the object would fly over my head and go right through the door outside. And one of our friends was out there near the van because he was helping us move stuff. He goes, what was that? It would be a statue of Jesus that you put, was a suction cup that you put on your car, like the visor.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, I know.
And
I know.
I said, well, I guess Jesus did a flyby. And I said, I have no idea where that statue came from. I've never seen it. I don't know what it's doing, but there it goes. And that's the kind of stuff, like, we would be laughing sometimes. It would be so sinister. Sometimes you'd just be crying because you just, I can't take anymore. I mean, having stuff thrown over, like my son going out the door and a bunch of stuff from the table. There's like a pack of pencils in a mug, and the mug would just fly at him with all the pencils and all over the floor. He goes, that thing just attacked me. So that thing just came out.
So let me ask
we talk about it all the time.
Did it stay in the basement and do this stuff, or did you ever see anything like in the bedrooms or other part of your house?
Yeah, it traveled. At one point it was just in the basement, and then it brought itself up because things were happening in the bedroom where we would have things against the wall and they would just be thrown over on the floor. There would be things upstairs like a dimmer switch that you can screw off. They love taking the dimmer switch off and throwing it into another room. I go, why? Like, why are you throwing this dimmer switch? You know, like, are you getting my attention? Yeah, you got my attention. Or you're in the kitchen and I'm trying to empty cabinets and you hear this like a clang, and it's over my head. And I didn't know there was a little shelf above the door frame. And it was a little silver bracelet that must have belonged to his mother that hit on the shelf. And it's like, okay, somebody get me a ladder. Let me look what's on the shelf. There's a little silver bracelet up here, that a little bangle bracelet that just hit up on here. So it just all through, and even a garden house. That's where we were in the garden house getting rid of stuff in there. I turned around, came out the door, and somebody pushed me from the back, my small of my back, pushed me forward, and I fell over. There was boxes that I had black and blue all over my left leg and thigh for a couple of weeks because I had shorts on. It was in the middle of June.
You know what? Does that see? That's when it's not.
And that's before my son. Oh yeah, it was getting bad. That's why we wanted to be out of there, Marlene, because it was August that my son, he was coming out of the kitchen. He was going through, it was like a rancher. So everything was on one level except for the basement, but he was going from one room to the other. And he, all of a sudden, he felt somebody grab his ankle and tripped him, and he fell flat on the floor. He thought he broke his glasses. I thought he broke his arm. He was just, the wind was just knocked out of him for like five, 10 minutes. And he said, I said, what happened? Did you trip over something? He goes, no, something grabbed my ankle. He said, and I fell. I had no way to catch myself. And that's what it was like. I was helpless too when coming out of the garden house. Just someone just pushed you because nobody was in the room behind me. They were already outside. And I fell before anybody could catch me. They said, that happened so sudden. One minute you're at the door frame coming out the door, and the next thing you're on the ground. So that's, you have no control because you don't expect it, you know, that you can't even catch yourself. So that, but see over here now at the house, I've been physically attacked with scratch marks that draw blood. So that's when Bill has been up here. And, you know, it's almost like rescue mode. And he goes, I'm coming up. So he's done things here too, because he knows of a demonic presence. And it has to deal with artifacts and some of the energy connected to my friend's family that dates back from World War II. So that's why I tell people, you got to read both of my books, because the second book, I did a lot of research on World War II. My dad was in World War II as a B-24 pilot. I mean, he was he was on a Liberator as a assistant to the pilot, but also a radio man. But he could also be a what they call co-pilot if he needed to be. They did all these missions from Italy, you know, in Europe. And so I had, my dad gave me some references, and then I did a lot of research on my own. And this is before so much of the stuff came out about Nazism and the occult, you know, with Hitler.
Right.
I did all this research, and a lot of my blogs delve into this because I had no idea how much the occult factor into the early Nazi ideology and what they were, you know, into as far as believing that they could take over the world, that they were the chosen people. And
right, when you see that Indiana, do you remember that old Indiana Jones movie, the original one, that the premise was that here they're going after all these artifacts that are metaphysical or religious?
Exactly.
And they had a hardcore interest in
that. That is true. Yes. They had people, he had archaeologists and researchers go to the Himalaya mountains to study the Tibetan scrolls there that they thought there was hidden things. They were in all parts. They took the Spear of Destiny, which was in one of the in Austrian museum, which has now been returned. But that was supposed to be the spear that lanced Christ in the side of his stomach. You know, and has supposed at some place to have that, to be the nails that crucified Christ. All these things, you know, they were looking for the Holy Grail. I mean, all these things they were looking for because, you know, they felt like that has hidden power. And Hitler was really into this. And he the more and more there's actually groups that really fed into this, that there was, I didn't realize how much occultism and spiritualism after their defeat in World War I, Germany went big time into trying to figure out, why do we get defeated? You know, we're special people. And they really bought into that, you know, occultism and spiritualism, and not so much witchcraft, but black dark arts kind of stuff. And more like Satanism and things. And the actual SS group was modified after, you know, almost like the Knights Templar, but they were done in an evil practice. That's what you had. The SS were special offshoot of the regular Nazi army. So a lot of this figured in when I was doing my research for my second book because of my friend's family and the background. And I don't want to give too much away because it really was a shocker to understand how much kind of that was carried over. And then we were dealing with it. So you know,
right. And it makes you wonder.
I actually had to pick up a little bit of German to understand. Yeah. Yeah. Does evil last even though that they are gone? There's still, you know, a talk of a Fourth Reich that been South America. And my friend's family, I mean, his father did travel down to South America about 15 times. They were down back and forth every year going right. down to South America. So I had wondered, that's kind of the connection too. I wonder why that the family's going down there too. So there's a lot that kind of all, it's just like a whole circle of things that I'm trying to understand. We're still trying to understand. And it's all part of the mystery, Marlene. And it continues because we still have, we have some things happen on a regular basis uh-huh. in the house. It's things kind of escalate sometimes and then they settle down for a good while, you know? And
okay.
Some days are like Sundays tend to be a kind of an active day where something okay. will happen. I go, I'm not surprised it's a Sunday or, you know, an anniversary kind of thing creps up. So
you've noticed like, you know, I'm
a novice at this. Yeah. There's always been like a pattern of when the things started happening in our house, there was a big 2010 was a big whole section month after month. There was just so much going on. And so when we finally were putting things out on, like I finally on Facebook, it was past 2011 or 12. I was getting my first book. I was getting that together and I was sort of sidelined because my dad died in 2011 and I was helping to take care of him. And then my mom was sick for the last 2 years. She died in 2013. So I had an agent at that time that we were working on to getting the book published, but there was just so many things that sidelined me that we didn't publish it till January 2014, the first book, A State of Horror. And that's when we were then contacted a few months later by a haunting TV show because they had seen that the book sold quite a bit on Amazon the first
okay.
6 months. I was really shocked doing that, but we had a lot of sales. And then I was getting interest from paranormal TV groups and stuff like, you know, we'd like to maybe do the show. And finally, you know, A Haunting, they were the ones that actually, they went through and were able to, okay, connect with us. Yes, we're going to do this. You know, we've got the money put aside. We've got a screenwriter who's going to work from mm-hmm. the books and things. So they were able to get it together because another outfit was interested. And they've contacted me after. And I said, well, you guys lost out because you contacted me first and we were going to give you the story, but you didn't seem to do anything with it. And we didn't
right,
hear from you.
Move forward on it.
So the next group, you know, and we had the producer, they were ready to go. And then we were interviewed in August of 2014. And by December is when a Portal of Doom came out. And that's one of their most viewed episodes in the history of the show too. And also it's been very popular because people kind of identified because it had a real unique, like a story behind it with the
artifact.
Absolutely.
Yes. I would say that yeah. right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And the long standing of the connection that we weren't just in a house to clear it out because that was our job. He was a family friend and I knew the family for so long, plus the personal connection. So there was a lot that had to be digested and they did a really good job, I thought, with the episode. And some people said, too bad they didn't do a part two. And, you know, we have a couple things that are being negotiated, but nothing on firm right now that some people have been interested, maybe do a docudrama, you know, but, you know, a couple things have been floated, but, you know, there's an interest from a Canadian media group. They've been in touch with me this past year. And I said, well, I said, the story hasn't changed. I said, it's really up to you if you decide that you want me in your wheelhouse of stories for your television show. So they've had different people connect with me and we've gone through the process, but I know how long these things take sometimes.
Let me ask you, did his brother ever mention anything that happened to him? Or was it strictly you guys?
No. But you know what he said to me? When I mentioned to him after, it was pretty much he was taking everything he needed to take. I boxed up things for him and he was very grateful. And I told him, I said, look, I said, there's some really unusual things been going on in the house. He goes, oh, I'm not surprised. I go, really? I said, I was hesitant to tell you. Because, oh, I'm not surprised. He said, my brother, I see, he said, used to go to Germany and visit family, and he wasn't welcome, or I don't know. He had a big blowout with relatives in Germany, and he said, I think he was cursed. Like, he just said it so matter of fact. I said, Carl, I said, I mean, that's a really harsh thing to say, because maybe he had a family feud or something didn't go well overseas, and to say they probably cursed him. I go, that was really weird. So I haven't talked to his brother since we closed the house and the estate. I haven't talked to him since. So,
right, because one thing is like that you have a disagreement. Yeah, but to go from, hey, you know, he had a fight or an argument with a family member to he was cursed is like, okay, so there's something here. Why would you suspect your family is going to do this?
Yeah,
you know,
I think there's more to that than I didn't want to get into that at all, Marlene. I don't want to open that can of worms.
Yes.
Like, there's no way I'm going to get into this. I mean, I got enough to deal with. But yeah, there was some really just some strange vibes going on. And as I said, I did my part. And, you know, and then there's things that a friendship, you know, you go beyond certain things. And it's like, you know what? I shouldn't have to even discover some of these things. You know, like, it's not, that wasn't even my place, you know, to really see some of this. But it's like, if it hits you in the face, though, literally, like Poltergeist,
that's
like,
the thing,
you know, we have, to get into this. I mean, yeah. I mean,
well, Anita, this thing morphed for you from doing the right thing for your friend to, you know, basically, like you said, almost you spent a whole year dealing with it. It's like, how could you not at some point start realizing, I need to find out what the origin of this is at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and the more that we delve in, you know, we've actually, it's been recorded. Like, I was on a show a few years ago, and as we were talking and we're discussing about the artifacts, and the people in the chat room were hearing voices with accents, German accents, actually threatening me. So later on, the producer of the show sent us a transcript and said, check this out and see what you can hear. So we had the show was recorded. My son hadn't heard the show because he wasn't there that evening. I was doing the show with her. He then listened to it himself and started writing down the EVPs that he could hear during our interview. And when he showed it to me, go, yeah, a lot of them are similar to what the people said they heard in the chat room. Like, throw acid in her face. Don't let her talk about us that way. Yeah, really.
Oh, my God.
Crazy. Yeah, yeah, just really fright. And we've had that kind of language we've heard on EVP stuff, like, you know, I'm going to get you. Like, how dare you, you know, talk about my family? Well, you know what? If you didn't want us to talk about your family, maybe you should have left us alone, because, you know, we don't know what we're dealing with here. And we've been threatened. We've been, you know, attacked. So, you know, it comes with the territory.
So this comes, maybe basically, they're identifying with family with, let me ask you, did he have, because it sounds like maybe he had a couple of generations here in the United States, and then the rest of the family was in Germany. So did he ever have stuff that he brought over from Germany that was family stuff?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Nazi insignia stuff. And Mein Kampf in the German, the original German book of, you know, of Hitler.
Wow.
And I mean, yeah, his father had all this stuff. So, because his father was an SS officer. So
I was gonna say, yeah, this sounds not like your typical run of the mill German family. Yeah. who were living in Germany, and it's like, this is where we lived.
Well, his great uncle, my friend's great uncle, was a baron in Germany. They lost everything in World War I. In fact, his great aunt was a lady in waiting to the last empress of Germany.
Wow.
So we're talking about the Kaiser. And then their castle was over on the other side of the Berlin Wall and became the Russians took it over and became a museum. So my friend used to say, you know, yeah, there's a castle there, but, you know, it's been overtaken by the state, you know, that's no longer in the family. But his mother used to tell me stories that when she was a little girl to go visit this uncle, and they used to go play down in the dungeon, in the catacomb, like in the castle.
Okay.
Oh yeah, it was real fun exploring that.
I was like, yeah, where are the kids? Yeah, they're down. But right. Yeah. It's something that you take for granted, because that's when you're a kid, it's like, it's, that's just,
yeah.
Can everybody have a castle?
Yeah. Well, and his mother's family, the one, I think her father or uncle was a burgomeister. I mean, she came from a very wealthy family, my friend's mother, and they had, you know, this royalty connection. And then, his father being this military man, I mean, she was supposedly, he told me his mother was engaged to the French designer Lacroix before World War II broke out. And because she was Lutheran and he was Roman Catholic, the families wouldn't let them marry. So she, I think, married his father on the rebound. I mean, I'm just surmising this, but, you know, and I didn't have any images of his father wearing any uniform, but I had given the brother all these pictures and things. And I was wondering, one picture of his father is in this dark, like long coat with the military hat on, like a captain's hat, whatever it was. And he was with other gentlemen in front of a building. And when I gave it, I said, look, I found all these pictures of your dad. And, you know, I want to give all these pictures to you. And I just said to him, he goes, oh, well, my dad was in a special group, you know, in the military. And I didn't know enough to even say, I didn't know what that was, you know. And I gave him all these things. But then when we were cleaning out the one bedroom, his parents' room, we were pulling up, it was just an area rug. We were pulling up the area rug because there was some furniture stuck. And I said, well, look, you know, get that piece of furniture. We'll have to pull up the rug and see if we can, you know, clear this out. And there was a black pamphlet or a booklet under there. And I pulled up, and there it is, the swastika with the eagle, you know, the Nazi insignia. And I go, and I looked, and there's his father in a military outfit, and there's like all this German writing. So I brought it home that night to my parents. We were having dinner over there, and I show it to my dad, and he looked at it, and he got really silent. I said, what do you think of it? He goes, your friend's father, the SOB, was SS. I go, how did you know that, Dad? I just know. He said, look, I was in World War II. I know what these guys carried. This was a military pass they carried from area to area, which had logged in all their immunization shots so they could travel. So they had like polio or tetanus shots. So this was like his pass to get around. You're supposed to turn those in after the military service is over. And he never did, because I guess he was proud of it. So my dad looked at, and I said, well, I'm going to give it back to the brother. You know, like, it belongs to him. My dad said, well, so I'm just telling you. I go, Dad, I don't think so, because I knew his parents. Like, I never dreamed of it. But then later on, it was verified to me that a neighbor happened to get in touch with me, because she had moved but had sent a letter to his house asking how he was doing. She didn't know he had passed away. So what I did was I wrote back to her, because I knew she was a good friend, and sent her his obituary and all, because I had a memorial service for him that I had to do by myself to get that all together. His brother didn't help me out, and my friend was cremated. So we did what we could do, you know. And I mean, did a display. I had to get some catering people to come in, try, because he was well known in the community, because he wrote a lot of things for local churches and stuff. But I was doing that, and I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
No. It's okay. The thing about that, that his dad and everything about what your dad said, that this guy was.
So it was a friend that I wrote to and sent the obituary information. So she called me, because I said, if you want to give me a call, I think it was Nora. I said, Nora, just let me know. So she called me. She said, thank you for sending all this. She said, I'm really shocked to know that he passed. And we started talking, and I said, well, I'm cleaning out the house, Nora. I said, it's such a big job. And I said something about, you know, he's very proud of his heritage and the father. And she goes, well, you know, Mr. So-and-so was SS. I go, Nora, I'm gonna drop the phone over here. Like, just don't say a statement like that. How do you know this? I go, like, I'm like stunned. And I, because this is now verification of what my dad said. And it's like two different, she didn't even know anything, like what was gonna go on. And so I said to her, how do you know this? She said, well, his wife, which is my friend's mother, was good friends with her mother, Nora's mother. They're about the same age. And but they happen to be Jewish. But her mother got along with her. Her mother was Jewish, and they respected very each other. His mother did beautiful designing, and I found clothes that she designed with her own label in the house when I was going through everything. And you know, having this connection with this French designer too. And her mother also did clothing and was seamstress and all that. So they kind of bonded being neighbors and did. And just in talking, she let it slip one day. She goes, yeah, we knew everything that was going on with the Jewish people. Like, you know, they feigned ignorance, but we knew what was going on. And she told him how sorry she was because Nora and her mother were leaving the neighborhood and moving to Florida because, and her mother was going with her. Her mother was elderly and she wanted her mother to go with her. So these two women were never going to see each other again. So my friend's mother said to her, you know, I'm sorry that this happened because this is on my conscience, you know, that we knew what was going on. And, you know, for the Jewish people. And, exactly. And so that's how she knew that from the family. Like they said they always knew he was mysterious, the mysterious Mr. So-and-so in the neighborhood. And I said, well, I mean, I wasn't a neighbor. I wasn't in the neighborhood. So I only knew from a distance, you know, knew him. But, you know, he was always friendly to me. His mother, you know, she was good to my son. She was very sweet. So that's how we got to know this. And then, of course, you find, you know, Nazi connections, you find pins. Right. I have Nazi pins that were from 1930s rallies that the Nazis held and stuff. Wow. So there's artifacts. I have the daggers, I think, are probably one of the biggest things, that the daggers probably were used in World War One, and you know, because he kept those. Okay. And then it was from World War Two. And so there's some, but there was a German Luger we didn't find in the house, but we found the holster to it. But my friend's place had been broken into about a year before he died, and he put bars on the windows and he had a security system put in. So they never found the German Luger, but I found bullets on the floor that belonged to a German Luger. So I said, yeah, it must be that these guys did get the German Luger that belonged to his father that they stole. I mean, they went through the house. My friend didn't keep a lot of like valuables, but they ransacked the place, you know, and he had been downtown in Philadelphia doing a program for one of the clubs or something. And he was just so upset when he came home. He felt so violated. So he then put a security system, put bars on his window, and he became almost like a recluse after that. That last year or two before he died, he wouldn't let me in the house. I would have him over my house for dinner or lunch. And he just didn't want people to go into the house. So it's a shame. I just think it preyed on his mind.
You know what, but it's incredible that like you said, that after the fact is when you find out all this thing about the history of his family. Yeah. And it's like, you know, and it's like almost like different sources where some of this stuff is coming from, you know. Mm-hmm. Is it that connection, like a family thing? Is it part of the art? Or it could also be a little bit of each, all these artifacts, like you said, from different parts of the world that have their own, some type of attachment to it.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have a Peruvian mummy doll. I have a doll that they call it a Peruvian. It's actually made by the natives. It's made of grass and straw, and it's like a rag doll, but the actual material that it's dressed in comes from actual ancient mummy wrappings that the people in the 1950s, they used to do that. So they sold to the tourists.
No. The thing is that people don't realize that in like the Aztec, the Mayan, and the Incan, depending on some of their artifacts, you know, they were into human sacrifice. That's a dark aspect to their culture, you know. Yeah. You know, you also hear that.
Yeah, there is.
The time period when things were handcrafted, that whoever worked on maybe a doll or whatever, like depending on what type of person they were or what they were doing, I don't know, if inside their head, it kind of sometimes gets transferred into the object that they were creating.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not like that's now, like everything's manufactured. You know.
Definitely. That's what they use in the, like, voodoo, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. But you know, that's where the voodoo comes from when people are manufactured. It's the intent you're putting behind it. I mean, these were, The mummy wrappings, what happened was so much was being taken from grave robbing that the nearby villages would find all these wrappings just in the desert, you know, and they're not being disintegrated because it's so dry. So in the 1950s, they were making these dolls, between a mother and a child, and all the textiles were like at least 500 years old. They were taking it from the mummy wrappings making these dolls up. And my friend, when he was down in Peru, you know, he had bought one of these, and you know, it has energy, and you know, then of course other things that he bought from different places. I mean, he's got Native American things that, you know, he bought on his travels. I mean, I'm actually going to contact in Washington, D.C., the Native American Museum, because I have a shaman's buffalo headdress that I found in two different separate packages. And I've been restoring that it's just fabulous. I mean, it's the buffalo horns and the beadwork and the buffalo piece that goes in the back head of the, of the wearer. And, and I don't know, so I want to contact them to say, this is Plains Indian for sure. It's got to be, at least I think around 1870, 1880, and I don't know where he got this. There's no documentation. He might just picked it up in his travels. And so there's things that, the Native Museum might be interested in, and they could restore it back to its original look, which, sure. I'd rather that, instead of it just being staying in a box, but I put acid free tissue paper. I was able to, and you try to preserve it. The best thing I tell people too is just get pure cotton, like sheets. If you have anything that's cotton, that's really maybe even old stuff, just use those cotton things and wrap it, because the cotton will not harm, it's like acid free when you have pure cotton, an old tablecloth or pillowcases.
People don't realize that even
have something that's not.
Dana, this is a real short story. This is this happened not too long ago. I mean, as far as the that there's a dark aspect to about, I want to say like maybe a year ago, I was reading this story down in Brazil. There's a young girl. When I mean young, in her 20s, she's married to, they said it was an ex-military guy. He gets shot when they're coming into, he's coming into the house. It doesn't really explain that maybe it was just maybe something related to his work or who knows what. Somebody in a motorcycle. So she inherits his home. This is the wife, right? Small house.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there was some type of dispute with her and her brother-in-law. In other words, her dead husband's brother. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, 2 years down the road, he goes in there with another guy, shoots her dead. And her mom, her mom was living with her, shoots her mom, but her mom doesn't die. But she dies.
Mm-hmm.
They bury her. Then somebody broke into her grave like 3 months after her burial, took her head,
mm-hmm.
and they left like a planter. And they were discussing that, contrary to what people believe, there's still in a lot of these countries, even in modern times, there's a lot of dark magic rituals mm-hmm. going on, because the this was like in a village. This was not like the main, city in Brazil. This is like on the outskirts, mm-hmm, kind of mm-hmm. more country, and the cemeteries.
Yeah.
They're not mm-hmm. like, it's not like, but just the fact that they took the head, that they were saying, oh, this is tied into. And by the way, her ex, well, brother-in-law, he did get arrested, and uh-huh. he spent like 9 months in jail, and then they let him go like pending trial. And what's really unusual is that I tell people don't realize that in a lot of these countries, they'll do kind of dark magic and rituals when they've got stuff like this guy that was in jail.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like get me mm-hmm. out of here kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Her dad found out when he visited the grave what had happened. And they're saying, that's as far as the attachment.
It's great. There's so much. Yeah. And that's something that I had to learn, that inanimate objects had attachments to them, because
yes.
it just wasn't something that I even really thought about it. I mean, now I deal with antique dolls and I restore them and old mm-hmm. paintings and things like that. And it never even crossed my mind that the dolls could be evil or there's anything attached to it, because I've been a doll collector all my life. But now, of course, Hollywood has made, a big money maker because of, the Annabelle doll, and just crazy because I'm in with so many of the doll groups that we cherish these antique dolls, because they're made and they'll never be made again because of the great workmanship, yes, and the beautiful costumes. And some dolls, yes, are going for a fortune. Like, you could buy a house for what one of these dolls are going for now because they're, yes, so rare. But, you know, people ask me, don't they creep you out? I go, no, a doll never creeped me out because they're beautiful objects. Now, of course, clowns are supposed to be that scary to people, but it never really crossed my mind that my dolls were going to be sinister or evil or anything, because they've been all, yes, loved and cherished by little girls, you know, and people grew up with these. I mean, a lot of, yes, times children weren't allowed to play with dolls until on Sunday because you're in your Sunday best and you have a doll that's breakable. So, you know, that's the only time you're going to play with it. But when you see dolls are more worn, then you know they've been really loved because you could see the, yes, back of the head. If it's a porcelain doll, it's been worn because you're holding it, you know, close. And I do a lot of lectures for people about history with antique, about dolls. Dolls are, as soon as you had children in, you know, in the culture and on this planet, you know, you had some kind of representation to for a child to play with. So, you know, anything that represents like a comfort kind of a toy, you know, people have made them from ancient Egyptians. There's dolls, you know, that you know, wooden, they're made of any kind of material you can imagine. Of course, the Barbie dolls, when I was growing up, Barbie dolls was a big thing. Yes, but I always loved the antique dolls because the German factories had some of the most beautiful dolls and they were very popular. And then the French did some of the most exquisite French fashion dolls. But it's all part of, I think, my history. It's weird how it happens, Marlene, that your interests and what you're doing, that I got involved into the paranormal, which I never dreamed I'd ever be even in this.
If because you of this.
Told me 15 years ago. I mean, I was an artist, a teacher. You know, my son and I, we have a hobby store that's almost 10 years. I've always done art projects. I've always done commission work, paintings, portraits, still lifes. Landscapes. I've been out west. I love the Native American culture. That I've been out west many times and painted the Native American pictures and things. But yeah, this was a whole new thing. And then for me to write the books too, that was something.
Sure.
I always liked writing. I always did poetry and short stories when I was a kid. But I thought, well, you know, I can give it a try. And then, you know, producing the manuscript, I learned everything just by watching YouTube or just exploring on my own. Nobody was there to help me how to get the manuscript, yeah, together, how to write a query letter to a agent. But I did that all on my own. And now I've had my agent. It's over 10 years we've been together, and she's just wonderful. And I was lucky that she thought enough of my manuscript when I sent it to her. She says, I'll take this on. And, you know, she does the negotiations. Like, she will be part of, she's also a lawyer that she helped me out with a lot of legal issues and things. And, you know, she's there if something were to come of the story or we make more from my books. You know, I mean, she's there to be on my lookout. She's got my back, sure, because so many people, yeah, they'll get involved in something and they don't know the logistics or the legal matters,
yes,
behind it.
But the ramifications,
you know, you can't
are.
Give your rights away. You have to be so careful. You know, if somebody wants to quickly. Yeah, you know, or they'll manipulate. They say, oh, you're naive. They don't know anything about this. And I've talked to other groups. I said, there's a lot that goes into when you are producing a book. You know, you have to do the right steps, you know. So she, mm-hmm, my agent and I, we've actually helped other authors. I've did a few book covers for them. She does editing. And we try to get them through the process. We talk them through, like, what the steps are to go through. And we also have a freelancer who does some of the formatting for us for ebooks and if they want to do, particularly on their own, like go through Amazon or one of the other, you know, platforms. We do that too, that we help them say, okay, you have your manuscript. Now this is only the first step. We got to go through, you have to edit, you know, make sure,
right,
everything is going to be ready for when you want to take the next step, you know, and formatting, how many pages, chapters. So there's a lot that goes into it. And I've learned a lot just by doing my own books and then working with my agent because she's so good at it. You know, she's actually helped. She has, we have a couple different authors, you know, they have one man, he's written a couple travel books of all his far travels. He's really very, very knowledgeable. You know, it's been really fun. I was able to, being that I'm in photo, mm-hmm, restoration too, I was able to get his pictures formatted that he wanted in the book because it was a travel book and it had like 40 really beautiful photos he had taken. So I keep my hand in a little bit of everything. So it just keeps it interesting.
That's how you learn.
Living in a haunted house.
You have to dive in feet first,
you know,
and figure it out as you go along.
With our lives.
because if you wait, you know, that's the best thing, you know, you make mistakes and then you learn from them and move on. Because otherwise, you know, it gets put on the shelf.
Yeah.
And then you'll, I wish I could have written a book, or I wish I could have done that. Yeah. Yeah. And once you do it, you do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have another book planned?
Yeah. But I've enjoyed, you know, so many, you know, I've really, the journey, I'm like, I got to meet such nice people like you, so many people I've been with interviews and get to know what their whole process is and what they've been connected with. And it's opened up a whole division and things like that. And then to be in the paranormal community and in that phase, it's just, you know, you never know where your journey is going to take you. You just have to be open, I guess, for the possibilities. So I try to navigate pretty good.
Yeah. Do you, let me ask you, because things have calmed down, you said, at your house or anything or everything like that. You should, I mean, this is like a cautionary tale, what happened to you, almost like if you've got a good friend that wants you to like do away, you know, take care of his estate, think twice about it. That's like, and I think that's what's so intriguing about your story, Anita.
I've said that. What was that? Was that, I didn't catch the last little bit. It was breaking up a little bit.
No, I think it's so intriguing about the story. Uh-huh. That is that you went into it with, the last thing you were thinking about was ghosts, the supernatural and poltergeist or anything. You were going in there because your friend, your good friend is asking you, like, do this for me.
Yeah.
And this thing kind of mushroomed into, like, what is this?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
What do you...
That was... I mean, I was just worried about getting the house, getting that done. So it was...
No, I didn't totally expect understand.
What I walked into.
Anita, for my podcast listeners, what's your website where you can find you?
Well, I have a website. It's anitajointanzo.com. Mm-hmm. And it has I have a lot of different information on, you know, collecting dolls and photo restoration, but also there's links to my books. They can go to www.estateofhorror.com. That link will take you, I think, right to my website, and you can go on to Amazon where the book can be purchased. It's on ebook, it's on Kindle and paperback, and then also darktransference.com. But if they just go on my website, there's a lot of different things on there of interest. And also I wrote 2 years ago, I just wrote a book, a very small book about my parents and their unique love story, about my dad being in World War II and how being first generation Italian Americans, you know, the trials and tribulations that they went through, you know, growing up, and how they met. And it's just a unique story. And so I've been wanting to do that for a long time, and I'm glad because I was able then for my family to have that and treasure the story, the pictures in the book. Some my dad took when he was on the B-24 from his old Brownie camera, the old big box camera that he took pictures and that in the book. But it's called Destined to Love, A Daughter Remembers Her Parents' Unique Story. And that might be also in there because they'll say whatever Anita Jo Intenso might be, what other books. But yeah, they're the two books of on the paranormal, and everything's true. Everything's it's as we documented. I don't get into too much of you know, like preconceived ideas. I just basically report what happened with us and how our reactions and what the consequences were after, you know.
Right.
And as I said, I don't try to convert people. Like, they can hear my story. And as you said, it's a cautionary tale. Be careful what you promise to somebody if you can fulfill it, because sometimes it could be almost beyond your endurance, you know, if you need to do this. But I don't know. I'm a tough South Philly girl. Tough Italian girl that I tell the ghost story.
You know, I bet you weren't ready for this.
I've got too much to do. No. I it was a shocker, and just trying to just understand things, and then the consequences of, you know, having some things broken in front of you that mean a lot to you that you weren't expecting. Yes. I mean, that's mainly to hurt you, that they'll try to do something to hurt you or make you feel bad. They try to keep you off balance, that you're questioning your sanity at times. But my deep faith and believing in myself and believing in that there's a higher good, that I put a lot of faith, you know, in my Lord and Savior, that, I mean, and it's very personal to me. I don't go proselytizing to people, but it's helped me get through a lot of really dark times. Sure. And things. And also, as I spoke with you before, you know, with my son's recent health issue, but God's with me every day to help me navigate through. Yes. And, you know, and having good friends like Bill Bean, he's in our corner. He's been emailing me almost every other day with prayers. Okay. And he called us and just wanted him to know. He just said, my wife and I were praying for him. He did a huge prayer circle after I let him know what happened to my son. And okay. He said, we're on it, Anita. He said, we're going to be sending all the positivity to you. So he's been a wonderful friend. He's like family to us, that we got to meet him. And only because I ventured to even go on Facebook to ask, has anybody seen, we had weird fingerprints going on a mirrored surface, and someone looked at them. They said, you know, that doesn't look normal. That looks really scary. And she suggested Bill Bean. She said, he doesn't live that far. He's on the East Coast like you are. And she made an introduction. Bill called me. We texted back and he said, I'll be up there. And he was within a week. Wow. Or two. He made a schedule that he could come up and see us. Complete stranger, never even met him. But once we met him, he was like, we've known each other for years. It was like instant, right, like connection with him. And he's been just such a wonderful guy. We've been on joint shows with him. He was on our Haunting TV show, the episode. And he's just been a wonderful guy and a guide. When we need help, you know, we can ask him, and he helps us as much as he can.
That's great. So, let me tell you, he's a
wonderful
guy.
Grateful. So we have a lot to be grateful for, Marlene. You know, and I appreciate so much tonight.
No, on the contrary, it's my pleasure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to put a link to the website.
He's really a man of God.
Oh no, he's great. He's great. He's great. And
okay, thank you.
Wonderful. But anyway, I'll have a link to your website and the credits of the show. And I want to wish you the best of luck in everything, Anita. And please, the best wishes for your son, you know, for his recovery, even though it sounds like he's on the mend.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care. Bye bye.
Yes. Every day is a little bit better for him. Yeah. Thank you, Marlene.
Bye, sweetheart. Take care. Bye bye.
And you have a wonderful holiday.
You too. Yes, you too. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Wow. She's been here. This is her third time. And she talked about this before. And as you could tell, it is true. She was living her life in the sense of she's busy. She's got a business. Several businesses, you know, the restoral and all these things going on. And she had her parents, elderly parents. In other words, this is not like somebody that was like, I'm really bored and I think, you know, I'm going to imagine all these weird things. And here, you know, she's, you know what? And one of the things I remember from one of the prior shows that she told me was, she goes, now I understand why my friend would never have me over versus we would meet or he would come over for dinner for anything, because I want to say maybe a part of him knew, understood the hoarding situation going on. And I guess he didn't want her to see this, even though it's what they call an organized hoarder, where, you know, he had everything all boxed and stacked and this and that. But I think he realized, I can't help myself, but this is not normal. And even Anita, who was a good friend, if she would have come over, she would have been like, what? But again, I remember she even told me that he had even kept his parents' clothing, like a lot of the clothing even from his mom. But again, as difficult as that would have been, because all of a sudden you realize I'm responsible for getting rid of all these things and following his will, the flip side of it is that's difficult without the haunting going on. Now you go in there and you throw stuff like that, what she's describing, and it's like, okay. And let me tell you something. According to her, it's almost a year. A year is a long time, which tells you And she was saying we were working 40-hour work weeks. And for it to take 10 months, that tells you this man had a lot of stuff in there, a lot. And then that's why, you know, and again, it's like, I guess in that conversation never came up, but that you almost wish that you could ask him, well, obviously while he was alive, like, did anything ever happen here? Because obviously, besides if you want to go down the road of that, maybe her friend came back after he was dying or dead, I'm sorry, that something, there was an attachment to some artifact, God knows from where or how old it was. And sure, remember, because of his, you know, he's an anthropologist of many years, he knew what he was looking for. Because you have sometimes people go to these foreign countries and they'll buy stuff at bazaars, and it's like, yeah, for all you know, turn it over, it might have been made in China, in other words. But he, because of his training, probably knew what he was looking at was like, if it was an original artifact of some type. Sometimes those things, I've heard this before from other sources, some of those things you have to be really careful, because they do bring, either by mistake, they get attachments, or at some point during the time that they were being made, the intent was to use them as maybe either a fetish or something involving darker rituals. All right. So you would want, and then of course, there's the other aspect of that. He's got this very dark family history that, again, makes you wonder, did any of this bleed over into what was going on in his house, and now, by extension, Anita's house, right? So many questions, some that probably nobody will ever get answers to, because most of the people that could have said one way or the other are dead, starting with a friend. Then he could have said, yeah, Anita, I've, for the last, whatever, 10, 20 years, or whatever, that I've been living here, I had all this weird stuff going on in my house. That would have helped, but he's gone. And again, would he ever have said anything along the lines of, yeah, my dad, or my, you know, my family history in Germany is not only a Nazi, but an SS officer. Come on, let's face it. You kind of might want to keep that under your hat, because, I mean, it's not your fault. You can't help it, but still. But did that bring its own creepy factor in there? That's basically being, I don't know, expressed. It's like, wow. What, I wonder what Anita has. If it might even be more than one of those things that he gave her that is the point of origin. You know, like when they do these things for the diseases that you need to look for, patient zero. This is the nexus. This is where everything came from. Is there a patient zero or an artifact zero amongst all the things that she's got there? Interesting. I wonder if she would ever figure it out. All right, guys, I hope you really liked this interview with Anita. She is wonderful. Again, I'm going to have a link to her website on the credits of the show. Go to MP Pelliser, sign up for my newsletter. I've got, again, links there to everything. And if you even go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com or MP Pelliser, I have a link tree button down at the bottom, which again is going to get you connected to everywhere I'm at. So, and again, I have wonderful guests in the wings, really interesting people, some from before and a lot of new ones. All right. And like I said, right now, this will be part of season 15 of Stories of the Supernatural. Season 15. And at the rate I'm going with booking people, pretty soon I'm going to have to start opening up my calendar for season 16 at the rate I'm going. So, and again, I want to thank all of you for coming every week and joining me here. Again, remember, you are all wonderful. Take care. Till next time.